On the other hand, Chasseur thought it a sacrilege that a girl who had the face and body of a goddess should try to disguise these facts in an attempt to be taken for a daughter of the proletariat. Nor did he approve of this same young woman spending most of her waking hours either in study or in the slums and shanty towns that had sprung up on the Cape Flats, dishing out to a snot-nosed piccaninnies free soup, the ingredients of which she had helped obtain by standing on street corners with a beggar's box. He especially did not like the medical students and newly qualified young doctors, Bolsheviks one and all, with whom she spent so much time in her capacity as an unpaid and untrained nurse in the volunteer clinics, tending unwashed and highly infectious brown and black patients suffering from tuberculosis, syphilis, infant dysentery, scabies, the secondary effects of chronic alcoholism, and all the other unlovely consequences of poverty and ignorance. St. Francis of Assisi was lucky he didn't have you to compete with. You'd have made him look like Attila the Hun, he said. He found her friends boring in their serious single-mindedness and ostentatious in their left-wing beards and shoddy dress. They just lack any style or class, Tara. I mean, how can you bear to walk in the street with one of them? Their style is the style of the future, and their class is the class of all humanity, she replied. Now you are even talking like one of them, for cat's sake. However, these differences were mild and without real substance when compared to their truly monumental disagreement on the subjects of Tara Malcolmus's chastity and virginity. For God's sake, Tara, Queen Victoria has been dead for 37 years. This is the 20th century. Thank you for the history lesson, Chasseur Courtney, but if you try to get your hand into my bloomers again, I'm going to break your arm in three separate and distinct places. What have you got in there isn't so bloody special. There are plenty of other young ladies. Ladies is a euphemism, but let that pass, she said. I suggest that in the future you confine your attentions to them and leave me alone. That is the only sensible suggestion you have made all evening, Chasseur told her in an icy fury of frustration, and started the Jaguar sports car with a thunder of exhaust and superchargers that echoed through the pine forests and startled all the other couples parked in the darkness about the pseudo-Greek temple that was the memorial to Cecil John Rhodes. They drove down the winding mountain road at a savage pace, and Chasseur skidded the big sports car to a halt in the gravel in front of the double mahogany doors of the Malcolmus home. "Don't bother to hold the door for me," Tara said coldly, and slammed it so hard that he flinched. That had been 2 months before, and there hadn't been a day since then that Chasseur hadn't thought of her. When he was sweating in the heat of the great pit of the Harney mine, or poring over a contract with A.B. Abrahams in the Windhoek office, or watching the muddy brown waters of the Orange River being transformed into sheets of silver by the spinning overhead sprinklers of the irrigation equipment, Tara's image would pop uninvited into his mind. He tried to erase it by flying the tiger moth so low that the landing wheels raised puffs of dust from the surface of the Kalahari, or by absorbing himself in precise and intricate aerobatic evolutions, the spin and barrel roll and stall turn. But as soon as he landed, Tara's memory was waiting for him. He hunted the red-maned Kalahari lions in the desert wilderness beyond the mystic hills of the Harney, or immersed himself in the multifarious affairs of the Courtney companies, studying under his mother, watching her methods and absorbing her thinking, until she trusted him sufficiently to put him in control of some of the smaller subsidiaries. He played the game of polo with almost angry dedication, pushing himself and the horses under him to the outer limits, and brought the same single-minded determination to the pursuit and seduction of a daunting procession of women. Young and not so young, plain and pretty, married and single, more and less experienced. But when he saw Tara Malkomus again, he had the strange, hollow feeling that he had only been half alive during those months of separation. For her sister's wedding, Tara had put aside the pretentiously drab uniform of the left-wing intellectual, and as a bridesmaid, she was dressed in grey silk with a blue sheen to it, which, beautiful as it was, could not quite match the steely grey of her eyes. She had changed her hairstyle, cutting it short. The thick, smoky curls formed a neat cap around her head, leaving the back of her long neck bare, and this seemed to emphasize her height and the length and perfection of her limbs. They looked at each other for a moment across the length of the crowded marquee, and it seemed to Chasseur that lightning had flashed across the tent. For an instant, he knew that she had missed him as much and thought about him as often. Then she nodded politely and turned her full attention back to the man beside her. Chasseur had met him once before. His name was Hubert Langley, and he was one of Tara's Bleeding Heart Brigade. He wore a shabby tweed jacket with leather elbow patches when most of the other male guests were in morning dress. He was an inch shorter than Tara, with steel-rimmed spectacles and prematurely thinning blonde hair. His beard was the colour and texture of the plumage of a day-old chicken, and he lectured in sociology at the university. Tara had once confided in Chasseur, "Huey is actually a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. Isn't that remarkable?" Her voice was awed. "He is totally committed, and he has an absolutely brilliant mind." "One might call him a shining jewel in a greasy and grubby setting," Chasseur remarked, thereby precipitating another of their periodic estrangements. Now he watched as Huey laid one of his freckled paws on Tara's unblemished forearm. And when he touched Tara's cheek with his wispy moustaches and whispered one of the gems from that absolutely brilliant mind into her pink shell-like ear, Chasseur realized that slow strangulation was too good for him. He sauntered across the tent to intervene, and Tara greeted him coolly, perfectly hiding the fact that her pulse was thumping loudly in her ears. She hadn't realized how intensely she had missed him until she watched him making his speech, urbane and self-assured, amusing, and so infuriatingly good-looking. "However, we are not climbing on the same old merry-go-round again," she warned herself, and put up all her defenses as he took the chair on the other side of her and smiled at her and teased her lightly while looking at her with open admiration, which was so hard to resist. They had shared so much together, friends and places and fun and fights, and he knew exactly how to tickle her sense of humour. She realized that once she started to laugh, it was all over, and she held out against it. But he worked on her defenses with skill and perfect timing, adroitly breaking them down as swiftly as she set them up, until at last she surrendered with a tinkle of laughter which she could no longer contain, and he followed up swiftly, cutting her out from Huey's side. From the balcony, Matilda Janine singled out her elder sister and tossed her bouquet directly at her. Tara made no effort to catch it, but Chasseur snatched it out of the air and handed it to Tara with a bow, while the other wedding guests applauded and looked knowing. As soon as David and Matty had departed, dragging a bunch of old shoes and tin cans behind David's old bullnose Morris, Chasseur worked Tara out of the marquee and spirited her away in the Jaguar. He didn't make the mistake of taking her back up the mountain to the Rhodes Memorial, scene of their last historic battle. Instead, he drove out to Hout Bay and parked on the top of the precipitous cliffs. While the sun set in a silent bomb burst of orange and red into the sombre green Atlantic, they fell upon each other in a frenzy of reconciliation. Tara's body was divided into two zones by an invisible but distinct line around her waist. On occasions of extreme goodwill such as this, the area above the line was, after a suitable show of resistance, made available to him. However, the area south of the line was inviolate, a restriction that left them both strung up with nervous tension when in the dawn they finally and reluctantly parted with one last lingering kiss at Tara's front door. This latest reconciliation lasted 4 months, which was a new record for them. And after preparing an emotional balance sheet on which the many advantages of bachelorhood were overbalanced by one single weighty consideration, I cannot live without her, Shasa formally proposed marriage to Tara Malcomus and was devastated by her reply. "Don't be silly, Shasa. Apart from a sort of vulgar animal attraction, you and I have absolutely nothing in common." "That is the most utter bilge, Tara," he protested. "We come from the same backgrounds, we speak the same language, laugh at the same jokes. But, Shasa, you don't care." "You know that I plan to enter Parliament," he said. "That is a career decision, not a thing of the heart. That isn't caring for the poor and the needy and the helpless." "I care for the poor." "You care for Shasa Courtney. That's who you really care for." Her voice rasped like a stiletto drawn from its sheath. "For you, the poor is anybody who can afford to run only 5 polo ponies." "Your papa had 15 nags in training at the last count," he pointed out tartly. "You leave my father out of this," she flashed at him. "Daddy has done more for the black and brown people of this country." He held up both hands to stop her. "Come on, Tara. You know I am Blaine Malcomus's most ardent admirer. I was not trying to insult him. I was simply trying to get you to marry me." "It's no good, Shasa," she said. "It's one of my unshakable convictions that the vast wealth of this land must be redistributed, removed from the hands of the Courtneys and the Oppenheimers, and given..." "That's Hubert Langley speaking, not Tara Malcomus," he said. "Your little commie pal should think of generating new wealth rather than divvying up the old. When you take everything we have, the Courtneys and the Oppenheimers, and share it out equally, there would be enough for a square meal for everybody, and 24 hours later we would all be starving again, the Courtneys and the Oppenheimers included." "There you are," she was triumphant. "You are quite happy to see everybody starve but yourself." He gasped at the injustice and rallied to launch a full-scale counterattack. But just in time, he saw the steely grey battle light in her eyes and checked himself. "If you and I were married," he made his voice humble, "you could influence me, persuade me to your way of thinking." She had been poised for one of their marvellously exhilarating shouting matches, and now she looked slightly crestfallen. "You crafty little capitalist," she said, "that's not fighting fair." "I don't want to fight with you, my dear girl. In fact, what I want to do with you is diametrically the opposite of fighting." Despite herself, she giggled. "That's another thing I have against you. You carry your mind around in your underpants." "You still haven't answered my question. Will you marry me?" "I have an essay to hand in by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and I am on duty at the clinic from 6 o'clock this evening. Please take me home now, Shasa." "Yes or no?" he demanded. "Perhaps," she said, "but only after I detect a vast improvement in your social conscience, and certainly not before I have obtained my master's degree." "That's another 2 years," he said. 18 months, she corrected him. And even then, it's not a promise. It's only a big fat perhaps. I don't know if I can wait that long, he said. Then bye-bye, Shasta Courtney. They never extended their record beyond 4 months. For 3 days later, Shasta received a phone call. He was at his meeting with his mother and the new winemaker that Santayne had recently brought out to Veldhoven from France. They were discussing the designs for the labels on the latest vintage of Cabernet Sauvignon when Santayne's secretary came through to her office. There is a phone call for you, Master Shasta. I can't come now. Take a message and I'll call back. Shasta did not even look up from the display of labels on Santayne's desk. It's Miss Tara, and she says it's urgent. Shasta glanced sheepishly at Santayne. It was one of her strict maxims that business comes first, and did not mix with any of his social or sporting activities. But this time she gave him a nod. I won't be a minute. He hurried out and was back within seconds. What on earth is it? Santayne stood up quickly when she saw his face. Tara, he said. It's Tara. Is she all right? She's in jail. In December of the year 1838, on tributary of the Buffalo River, the Zulu king Dingaan had sent his impis of warriors, armed with rawhide shield and assegai, against the circle of wagons of the Boer Trekkers, the ancestors of the Africana people. The wheels of the wagons were bound together with trek chains, and the spaces between them blocked with thorn branches. The Boer Trekkers stood to the barricade with their long muzzle loaders, all of them veterans of a dozen such battles, brave men and the finest marksmen in the world. They shot down the Zulu hordes, choking the river from bank to bank with dead men and turning its waters crimson, so that forever after it was known as Blood River. On that day, the might of the Zulu Empire was shattered, and the Boer Trekker leaders, standing bareheaded on the battlefield, made a covenant with God to celebrate the anniversary of the victory with religious service and thanksgiving for all time. This day had become the most holy date in the Calvinistic Africana calendar after the day of Christ's birth. It celebrated all their aspirations as a people. It commemorated their sufferings and honored their heroes and their forefathers. Thus, the 100th anniversary of the battle had peculiar significance for the Afrikaners. And during the protracted celebrations, the leader of the Nationalist Party declared, "We must make South Africa safe for the white man. It is shameful that white men are forced to live and work beside lesser breeds. Coloured blood is bad blood, and we must be protected from it. We need a second great victory if white civilization is to be saved." Over the months that followed, Dr. Malan and his Nationalist Party introduced a series of racially oriented bills to the House. These ranged from making mixed marriages a crime to the physical segregation of the whites from men of colour, whether Asiatic or African, and disenfranchising all coloured persons who already had the vote, while ensuring that those who did not have it remained without it. Up until the middle of 1939, Herzog and Smuts had managed to head off or defeat these proposals. The South African census distinguished between the various racial groups, the Cape Coloured and other mixed breeds. These were not, as one might believe, the progeny of white settlers and the indigenous tribes, but were rather the remnants of the Khoisan tribes, the Hottentots and Bushmen and Amaras, together with descendants of Asiatic slaves who had been brought out to the Cape of Good Hope in the ships of the Dutch East India Company. Taken together, they were an attractive people, useful and productive members of a complex society. They tended to be small-boned and light-skinned, with almond eyes in faintly oriental features. They were cheerful, clever and quick-witted, fond of pageant and carnival and music, dexterous and willing workers, good Christians or devout Muslims. They had been civilized in Western European fashion for centuries and had lived in close and amiable association with the whites since the days of slavery. The Cape was their stronghold, and they were better off than most other coloured groups. They had the vote, albeit on a separate roll from the whites, and many of them, as skilled craftsmen and small traders, had achieved a standard of living and affluence surpassing that of many of their white neighbours. However, the majority of them were domestic servants or urban labourers, surviving just above or below subsistence level. These people now became the subject of Dr. Daniel Malan's attempts to enforce segregation in the Cape, as well as every other corner of the land. Herzog and Smuts were fully aware that many of their own followers sympathised with the nationalists, and that to oppose them rigidly might easily bring down the delicate coalition of their united party. Reluctantly, they put together a counter-proposal for residential segregation, which would disrupt the delicate social balance as little as possible, and which, while making law a situation which already existed, would appease their own party and cut the ground from under the nationalist opposition's feet. "We aim to peg the present position," General Jan Smuts explained, and a week after this explanation, a large, orderly crowd of coloured people, joined by many liberal whites, gathered in the Green Market Square in the centre of Cape Town, peaceably, to protest against the proposed legislation. Other organisations, the South African Communist Party and the African National Congress, the Trotsky National Liberation League and the African People's Organisation, scented blood in the air, and their members swelled the ranks of the gathering, while in the front row centre, right under the hastily erected speaker's stand, auburn hair shining and grey-blue eyes flashing with righteous ardour, stood Tara Malcolmess. At her side, but slightly below her level, was Hubert Langley, backed by a group of Huey's sociology students from the university. They stared up at the speaker, enthralled and enchanted. "This fellow is very good," Hubert wondered. "I wonder why we had never heard of him before." "He is from the Transvaal," one of his students had overheard and leaned across to explain. "One of the top men in the African National Congress on the Witwatersrand." Hubert nodded. "Do you know his name?" "Gama. Moses Gama. Moses, the name suits him. The one to lead his people out of captivity." Tara thought that she had seldom seen a finer-looking man, black or white. He was tall and lean, with the face of a young pharaoh, intelligent, noble and fierce. "We live in time of sorrow and great danger." Moses Gama's voice had a range and a timbre that made Tara shiver involuntarily. "A time that was foreseen in the Book of Proverbs." He paused, and then spread his hands in an eloquent gesture as he quoted. "There is a generation whose teeth are as swords, and their jaw teeth as knives, to devour the poor from the earth and the needy from among men." "That's magnificent," Tara shivered again. "My friends, we are the poor and the needy. When each of us stands alone, we are weak. Alone, we are the prey for those with teeth like swords. But together we can be strong. If we stand together, we can resist them." Tara joined in the applause, clapping until the palms of her hands were numb, and the speaker stood calmly waiting for silence. And then he went on. "The world is like a great pot of oil slowly heating. When it boils over, there will be turmoil and steam, and it will feed the fire beneath it. The flames will fly up to the sky, and afterwards nothing will be the same again. The world we know will be altered forever. And only one thing is certain. as certain as the rise of tomorrow's sun. The future belongs to the people, and Africa belongs to the Africans. Tara found she was weeping hysterically as she clapped and screamed her adulation. After Moses Gama, the other speakers were dull and halting, and she was angry with their ineptitude. But when she looked for him in the crowd, Moses Gama had disappeared. "A man like him dare not stay too long in one place," Hubert explained. "They have to move like the will-o'-the-wisp to keep ahead of the police. A general never fights in the front line. They are too valuable to the revolution to be used as cannon fodder. Lenin only returned to Russia after the fighting was over. But we will hear of Moses Gama again, mark my words." Around them the crowd was being marshalled to form up into a procession behind a band, a 15-piece marching band. Any gathering was an excuse for the Cape-coloured people to make music, and in ranks 4 and 5 abreast, the demonstration began to snake out of the square. The band played Alabama, setting a festive mood, and the crowd was laughing and singing. It seemed a parade rather than a demonstration. "We will be peaceful and orderly," the organisers reinforced their previous orders, passing them down the column. "No trouble. We want no trouble with the police. We are going to march to the Parliament building and hand a petition to the Prime Minister." There were 2,000 or 3,000 in the procession, more than they had hoped for. Tara marched in the 5th rank, just behind Dr. Ghulam Ghul and his daughter Sissy and the other coloured leaders. With the band leading them, they turned into Adderley Street, the main city thoroughfare. As they marched up towards the Parliament building, the ranks of the procession were swelled by the idlers and the curious, so that as their leaders attempted to turn into Parliament Lane, they were followed by a column of 5,000, a quarter of a mile long, almost half of whom were there for the fun and the excitement, rather than from any political motives. At the entrance to Parliament Lane, a small detachment of police was waiting for them. The road had been barricaded, and there were more police armed with batons and jamboks, those long black whips of hippo hide, being held in reserve further up the road in front of the fence of cast-iron palings which protected the Parliament building. The procession came to a ragged halt at the police barrier, and Dr. Ghul signalled the band to silence, then went forward to parley with the white police inspector commanding the detail, while the photographers and reporters from local newspapers crowded around them to record the negotiations. "I wish to present a petition to the Prime Minister on behalf of the coloured people of the Cape Province," Dr. Ghul began. "Dr. Ghul, you are conducting an unlawful assembly, and I must ask you to get your people to disperse," the police inspector countered. None of his men had been issued with firearms, and the atmosphere was almost friendly. One of the trumpet players blew a loud raspberry, and the inspector smiled at the insult and wagged his finger like a schoolmaster at the culprit. The crowd laughed. This was the kind of paternal treatment which everybody understood. Dr. Ghul and the inspector haggled and argued in a good-natured fashion, undeterred by pleasantries from the wags in the crowd, until, finally, a parliamentary messenger was sent for. Dr. Ghul handed him the petition and then returned to address the procession. By this time, many of the idlers had lost interest and drifted away. Only the original nucleus of the procession remained. "My friends, our petition has been conveyed to the Prime Minister," Dr. Ghul told them. "We have achieved our object, and we can now rely on General Herzog, as a good man and a friend of the people, to do the just thing. I have promised the police that we will all go home quietly now, and that there will be no trouble." "We have been insulted," Hubert Langley called out loudly. "They will not even deign to speak to us.